Today is February 28th, 2019, and this is episode number 503 of the Apple Context Machine. That's a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Brian Chaffin, editor-in-chief of TMO, and a man who hardly knows which way is up anymore. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, you can head over to macobserver.com/contextmachine, and that'll take you straight to our Facebook group. Now, my guest today is a walking paradox. Singularly gentlemanly, and yet the TMO staff member most likely to require podcast hosts with a family-friendly show to need an edit.
Balderdash.
We have a phrase at TMO, and I'm not making this up. F***ing Martellaro, which we use to encapsulate everything about this man. And with that, John Martellaro.
Welcome to the show, everyone. This is episode 503. I'm betting that's a prime number.
Let's see.
Why that popped into my head, I have no idea.
I bet it is. Is this
prime time, prime number? Prime.
Let's find that out. Math.com 503. Is it prime? It is prime.
I guessed right.
Very, very, very well done, John. All right.
Happy to be with you on this Prime show.
I am happy to have you here on this Prime show.
I am happy to be here.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. And I like how you've already given me an edit to make, even though, no, it's just your fault.
Oh, you mean Balderdash?
No, I'm not. I'm not talking about our phrase that we use at TMO all the time. But today's show is not about that phrase. Today's show is about, I have my doubts as to whether we'll get to the second topic. Because we might go long on just one broad topic, which is robots, Apple and robots, and robots in general, and clergy.
Well, I like to talk about robots because I am one.
Yes, you are. Yes, you are a robot, John. Yes, you are. But all right, so where we're starting with this conversation is, surprisingly, with a religion.
And a mistake by me, because I had made a mental list of those occupations that I thought would be the last to be taken by robots. And clergymen was on my list of those things that would be very late to the robot's career, if ever. Because being a clergyman is not just about standing up and preaching, but a clergyman is somebody who's responsible for close religious and theological counsel, talking to young couples planning to get married, people in crisis, dealing with people who've spouses and relatives and friends who've passed away. And so there's a soul-to-soul human connection here that's really, really hard to envision.
Yeah, there's
that a robot could supply.
There's the espousing doctrine aspect of being a clergyman, and then there's the
right
communication side, which includes includes counseling.
So I wrote a story about a group that's chipped away at that hypothesis. Made its first cut. The other day I wrote an article that referenced a Telegraph article, Buddhist robot priest to dole out advice in Kyoto Temple. And quoting from the Telegraph, a 400-year-old temple in the deeply traditional Japanese city of Kyoto has unveiled a robotic deity, if you want to call it that, to deliver Buddhist teachings.
Is that actually a quote? Because it's not a deity. Why are they saying that?
That's
entirely just the wrong word.
Overly flowery, non-technical journalism.
Well, it's also just completely inaccurate. It's not a deity. Well, yeah, it's not a god.
Because in the very next phrase, it says to deliver Buddhist teachings, not to counsel the deepest human feelings and
emotions. Not even a counselor is a god. Well, I mean, I don't know. I suppose some counselor somewhere, maybe a god. But anyway, whatever. Mostly pedantic. Deity is the wrong word to use.
That's the wrong word. Yeah. But it was developed at a cost of about $880,000. A joint project between, again, I'm quoting from the Telegraph, joint project between the Zen Temple and Hiroshi Ishiguro, a professor of intelligent robotics at Osaka University. So as soon as I saw this, I thought at first blush, oh, here, we've chipped away at my list. But as you and I have previously discussed before the show started, this isn't all that it appears. It's mostly a teaching device and not so much a human counseling device.
Yeah, because
one can imagine that it would evolve into that.
Yeah, you got to start somewhere. But yeah. AI is nowhere near the point to be able to like offer counseling. And I don't know what they're doing. And this is one instance. I don't think that preachers and priests and I'm now drawing blanks on other religions' names for similar positions.
Rabbis,
thank you. And what does Islam call a preacher?
Good question.
I should
look that up.
This is ACM. We don't look up anything.
We're never prepared.
Yeah, we don't prep. That's silly. Anyway, a shaman, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think that folks need to worry about their gigs just yet. And this is also very specific to Japan, which has its own set of cultural issues involving, the lack of human interaction with each other, despite the cities like Tokyo that are extraordinarily crowded, and the insular way in which many people live their lives in Japan.
And yet reverence for age and the wisdom of the age. There is a meme in Japan that it's important to respect elders.
Yeah.
And to care for elders. And that's what's driving the robotics program in parts of Japan. And that is the grand vision of a family service robot that can help and assist the age, continue living with dignity and have assistance.
Yeah. Japan's population is aging rapidly. The Japanese population as a whole is having far fewer babies. I mean, they're actually looking at population contraction. And then they have an issue with they don't let many people into the country, and they don't let many people into the country to stay. So they don't like immigration in Japan. On the whole, that may be changing as they continue to have this population aging. Frankly, it's crisis.
I read an economic analysis one time that said that when that happens, immigration is important to provide for economic base and jobs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So anyway, I think the story is very specific to Japan, and but it is interesting. And to your point, it is certainly. I didn't make it the similar list that you had made, but if I had, I would have included clergy on it for sure.
One thing we got to remember here is that there's a double-edged sword in articles like this. This is not a one-off, because there have been other attempts like this before. One of my readers mentioned that in Germany there was a robot that was assisting with Martin Luther's 500th birthday celebration. So a one-off or a two-off or a 10-off or a 50-off doesn't make for an industry. And so millions of ministers and priests and rabbis and others are not going to be without jobs anytime soon. On the other hand, it inspires the imagination and looks forward to what might be in the future and causes us to ponder and think about whether this is a good thing, whether we want more of this, or whether we want less of this.
I've got a very knee-jerk reaction to that statement. And my very knee-jerk reaction to that statement is that until we have true and proper AI sentience, until and if we have true and proper AI sentience, I prefer to get my advice from people, from humans.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's talk about that, because I saw Kai-Fu Lee on 60 Minutes a couple of weeks ago. It's coincidental. I had John Markoff from the New York Times on Background Mode, and we talked about Kai-Fu Lee and robots. He's a noted AI expert. And then I saw him again on 60 Minutes talking about how he does not believe that artificial intelligence will ever achieve true sentience, consciousness, and humanness, identical in all respects to the most sophisticated of human minds. There's something special, he thinks, about our quantum connection to the universe, the mysteries of the mind that will never be solved. And, you know, physics humbles us. You know, there are lots of unanswered questions in science, and every time we answer one question, we get on to the next one, and we never get to the end of it.
Well, and to be fair...
And so there's no guarantee that we will ever solve the problem of consciousness.
And to be fair, man will never fly. That's poppycock. That's never going to happen.
Well, you know, we have to admit that the universe is infinitely difficult and enigmatic and mysterious, and it's a science humbles you, and so you have to be aggressive and optimistic and tackle big problems, as you say. But we have to also admit the fact that there might be things that humans can't understand completely.
We
never get to the bottom of quantum gravity versus relativity.
No, we haven't yet gotten to the bottom. What do you mean never did? It's not over.
Well, yeah, but it's been a difficult problem. Look at nuclear fusion.
Yeah, there's been lots of difficult problems.
We've been going after nuclear fusion for 60 years. There's no guarantee we'll ever get there.
That's right. There's no guarantee. And there is, in fact, no guarantee that artificial intelligence will ever achieve sentience. However, people who make stake in the claim.
I sense
the ground.
An Arthur Clarke rule coming here. When an elderly but distinguished scientist says something is impossible, he's probably wrong.
That's Arthur one of C. Clarke's Clark laws. That? He's probably
he did. Yeah, I think that's Clarke's first law.
I like that. I feel like it is insane to say never. That is ridiculous. To say that it's difficult and to even say that we don't even understand how difficult it is yet, that's wisdom. But to say that it ain't ever going to happen, that's ridiculous. I don't like it.
Well, remember, I'm not personally saying that.
I know, you're citing someone else. I'm poo-pooing that person.
Kai-Fu Lee. So I'm opening a discussion here about this.
Yeah. So I think it is likely that we will, for good and for ill, for both good and ill, because it's not going to be like good or ill. It's going to be good and ill. We will achieve sentience, or computers themselves will achieve sentience once we actually teach computers how to actually learn. Right?
The actual metric in this case, let's be clear, and we can refer to it later by name, is Star Trek's Lieutenant Commander Data. I mean, that is the symbolic thing we're driving at. An android, human form, sentient, sense of self, consciousness, aware of its mortality.
Form. Why does it have to be human form?
Why doesn't it have to be human form?
Well, I mean, I think sentience will happen in massive computing long before it could ever be squeezed into a human form. The first sentient computers will not be androids.
No, I'm talking about the ultimate manifestation of our vision.
Well, that's not what you said. You said the yardstick or the measure, the metric.
Yeah, so the ultimate manifestation of our goal is to create Lieutenant Commander Data in human form. NASA,
says you.
NASA, this is a NASA I have pointed to the NASA article that defines this.
So NASA is saying that the ultimate goal to define to for the ultimate goal or the ultimate definition?
The ultimate goal is to for human beings is to create Lieutenant Star Trek's Lieutenant Commander Data. It is the ultimate goal of our AI and robotic.
Okay, that research. Just seems a little bit wacky, but you know, whatevs. Whatevs. All right, well let's talk about before I get to Apple, before we get to Apple, I don't think we have even the vaguest understanding of exactly how powerful quantum computing might end up being.
I agree.
It of course could end up never amounting to anything, but I don't think that's going to happen. And the amount of power that could come online from quantum computing, especially from distributed processing in quantum computing, is like it is going to be world-changing for good and ill.
I have seen theories that consciousness is somehow tied to quantum effects in humans. So it could be that it requires a quantum computing element designed somehow to duplicate that human process.
Yeah, I don't know if quantum computing, as we're studying it now, will.
I'm not familiar enough with the physics of quantum computing.
We have definitely talked said more than we know.
Yes,
on this on that particular aspect.
Stole my phrase.
Totally stole it.
That.
Totally, it's brilliant.
John Marchalero Incorporated.
It's brilliant. Well, your lawyers can talk to my lawyers. That's fine.
All right.
That is a good line. So part of my point there is that's quantum computing is probably the most near future example of why I think it's ridiculous to say that computers will never be sentient or never be able to be as sentient as humans or whatever. Because I don't think we have any, even the vaguest understanding of exactly where quantum computing is going to take us.
Well, this brings up the next issue. And that is once you build a computer like that, assuming that we achieve it and the robot becomes fully sentient, self-conscious, then it deserves the dignity of human level of protection and legal status. So who owns the robot once it's turned on?
So in my book, the first sentient AI is named what is actually stemmed from a video game. And the video game was basically designed to scale with its user base and ended up being a big deal. Players started complaining, players started quitting because basically they couldn't beat the game anymore. They couldn't play, they couldn't succeed in the game anymore. And eventually that software became the first AI, and there was a big legal fight in which a human organization basically argued on behalf of the computer against the company that had created it, because the company that created it said they owned it. And a court case ended up deciding that sentience basically meant that you had the rights of a human. And all this is deep background in the story. That's not the point of the story at all. And I think that we will probably have fights and questions of, like, is it sentience that gives you rights, or is it having a soul? And I imagine that the religious elements, especially the conservative religious elements here in the States and elsewhere, will argue that the soul is what is paramount.
Well, not every. I'm a sort of an amateur theologian, I must admit. I teach some classes in it. Not every religion believes that the soul is some magical, spirit-like, separate entity that coexists within your body.
Indeed.
a lot of rational, very religious people would believe that the soul is basically what is the makeup and the totality of your physical, chemical, biological human brain, your personality, your character, your enduring state.
And that argument
could
be applied to Ascension AI. And that's part of where the arguments will be fought.
I know, and what I'm saying is it's dangerous to say that because a robot doesn't have a human soul, because you define the soul as some sort of God-given smoky spirit that coexists with inside you, that you can dominate the robot, destroy it, kill it.
But that
you
will
have
be
the right to do that.
But there will be people who argue precisely that, and there will be companies that argue precisely that.
That'll be a fun discussion to have. It'll be the new climate change argument in the next 20 years.
Yeah, probably in the next 20 years.
If we live long enough to have, if the human race survives long enough to endure climate change, we will have that discussion about robots.
Yes. Yes and yes. All right, well, so now let's bring this a little bit more down, way down to earth, and talk about Apple and robotics.
Let's do.
So the first thing is that Apple is invested in robotics now. And Apple, I don't know if
they
if
are.
It's,
we just don't know it.
Well, no, the Apple has said as much.
If you stand outside an Apple store with a white lab coat and ask somebody, is Apple into robots? They'll say no. But upon further reflection, as we will explain, Apple is deeply into robotics, just in a way we don't quite visualize.
Liam's successor.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, right. Apple has said that they're into robotics, but it's not making robotics for consumers.
Right.
Now, Apple says that they designed Liam.
Well, what I want to get to in a second, if you're ready for it, is that Apple's expertise in designing and building Liam is exactly the same technology that you need for artificial limbs.
And Liam is, by the way, just to refresh anyone who can't quite place that, Liam is the name.
You just told us that everybody knows, so you don't have to explain it.
I'm saying that it is not a secret, is what I'm saying. That Apple has said this.
Just giving you a hard time. Sorry. Make culpa.
Liam is Apple's robot that disassembles iPhones for the recycling process. And then there's a subsequent device too, and I forget what that one's name is. And Apple's released videos of this of Liam and the other one in action.
Yeah, isn't there also, there's another robot system that builds the Mac Pros, or used to.
Yes, and this is something that is probably, it is much less publicized by Apple, but has been reported that Apple ends up making a lot of the machines that make their stuff, even if those machines are being operated by third-party companies. Like Apple is heavily involved in developing those processes for third-party companies to make their components.
That's right. And so what this leads to is the three legs of the Apple triad for family robots. Excuse me.
Yeah, family robots.
The three legs are artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
Manufacturing robot technology.
Yeah.
And autonomous systems that can navigate, be spatially aware.
Self-driving autonomous systems. listen, John and I were on TDO this morning, and where that came into play. So anyway, feel free to listen to Thursday's Daily Observations show with Kelly. So go ahead.
So Apple has, I argue, the pieces into place, but it's not yet time for Apple to engage or think about family robots because there's so much work to be done on autonomous systems. We mentioned on TDO that Apple's autonomous cars were being, what is the term you used?
Let's scale back.
Driver control, no, driver intervention was being exercised every 1 mile or so.
Yeah, there was some kind of
autonomous.
Good.
An autonomous car has to be able to tell the difference between a traffic pylon or a trash can and a baby carriage. And if it can't tell the difference with almost perfect reliability of what's in front of it, what's around it, what to steer around, and what it can safely hit, then there's big trouble ahead for that autonomous system. And so that's the gateway to a robot being able to navigate around and treat humans safely and be aware of its surroundings and handle things, pick up babies safely and things like that. But it's a long way to go. And until Apple goes into production and gets up the learning curve in an autonomous ride-sharing vehicle, the company isn't ready to think about miniaturizing that process into a family service robot. So we're years away.
Well, there's so many things there. First of all, it is your premise that Apple will enter the personal or family robot market. Firstly, right?
Once those technologies are in place, yeah, it'll be an obvious thing to do. Plus, competition will compel Apple to do it, because if Apple doesn't do it right, like iPhone privacy, if we don't have Apple building our family robots, who can we trust?
Yes, I completely agree with that. The last thing I want is more corporate capital surveillance, capitalist devices in my home.
Right.
So secondly, the thing that we were talking about on TDO this morning is sort of tangentially related to all this. And that's that Apple told the state of California that it was eliminating 190 positions within Project Titan. And that includes roughly 124 engineers, including project managing engineers. And as part of that story, and this came out of the San Francisco Chronicle, as part of that story, Apple reported an error or a human driver taking control every 1.1 miles, and then, which John mentioned, but the key thing here is that, in comparison, Waymo had a quote-unquote disengagement every 11,017 miles, and another Bay Area autonomous vehicle company called Cruise had one every 5,204 miles. So, and this is all data from essentially calendar 2018. So we don't know what has happened since, but at least at that point, Apple was well behind its competition in terms of its autonomous systems actually being autonomous.
And yet, I wonder about that, because it's dangerous to cherry pick numbers like that, too.
It is very dangerous to cherry pick. I completely agree with that. But it, in that, I mean, you know, Waymo has been doing this longer, and I don't actually know anything about Cruise. You would expect Apple to be at least somewhat behind.
Let me give you an example of that. I've discussed this before, and I think I've written about it. You have a ride sharing service. You get on your phone, you bring up the app, you say, I want to go to the mall. So the van picks you up and drives you to the mall and drops you off, and you walk into the mall. Fine. Every 11,000 miles, there's a intervention and testing. But now you say, I want to go to the grocery store. And you expect the van to drop you off in very tight parking. Kids and their moms are walking through the aisles along with cars trying to find a parking place. You've got people with grocery carts. The van is trying to get you as close to the grocery store as possible so that you don't have to walk real far. And it has to navigate close quarters with pedestrians. That kind of task is a lot more complicated. And if Apple were to tackle a task like that, you would expect there would be more test driver interventions during the test phases.
But first of all, do we have to take a van?
Well...
Okay, maybe that wasn't the point of your story.
I make this really great technical point and explore it in great detail to tell us why 1.1 miles may not be so bad. And you ask me, does it have to be a van?
That's how That's how I roll. No, that is a very good point. We don't know exactly what kind of testing Apple has been doing. We do know that there is a military base that Apple and other companies have used. Mm-hmm. We know that Apple has cars. I think they're Lexus vehicles that are just generally speaking on the road. So I guess from November, the end of November 2017 to December 1st. In other words, 12 calendar months of 2018, Apple test drove 79,000 miles of testing, 79,745 miles of testing. Waymo and Cruise have both done a lot more in that same period. But again, we don't know what has happened since. We do know that Apple increased its fleet of vehicles, its test vehicles, in 2018. Excuse me. Yeah, in 2018.
How long do you think it's going to be before Apple rolls this thing out?
Or kills it?
I doubt that.
Will Apple
sell the vehicle to the ride-sharing services, or will Apple Inc. become your app builder and your company, and will have an Apple logo on the side, and the Apple van will be ordered by an Apple app and pick you up and
drive
you to the Apple store?
Does it have to be a van? Can it be something cooler than a van? I think that Apple will operate its own ride-sharing vehicle, own ride-sharing mm-hmm. fleet, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. partner with other companies in other markets. So, for instance, in China,
isn't the goal to put everybody else out of business? Isn't Apple's goal to come in,
no.
barge into this industry, take it over,
no.
do a better job than anybody else,
no.
and just dominate
well,
the
yeah,
market?
Well, doing better than everybody else, but I don't think Apple... Since when, I think the last thing Apple would want to do is put everyone else out of business, because then Apple has to actually, you know, cater to the riffraff. I mean, right? Apple wants to occupy the high end of the market everywhere it goes. So I don't think this market would be.
So you have to have a law degree before we'll honor your request for a ride.
No, I think it would be people willing to pay for a ride-sharing ride that's not tracking you, for instance, or has a more comfortable
people won't
line
be
of
aware
cars.
Of that. Oh, I don't know if people will actually be aware of that.
Well, Apple shouldn't bother to get into the business at all.
The Uber app was tracking people even before they called for a ride, and that was that secret was revealed last summer, I think.
Yeah,
people really didn't stop using Uber.
This is correct. People didn't stop using Uber, although Uber was forced to stop that practice. No, that's not true. They're still tracking you, I think, 5 minutes after you get out of the vehicle. Something along those lines.
Because somebody is willing to pay for information about where you went and what you bought.
There is no competition along what Apple could bring to the market here. And there's also integration into iOS that could be done. I do think there's room for Apple in this market. So, and this is all coming from Tim Cook saying that there are three aspects of the car market that he thinks are interesting, which is Cook code for saying that we're looking into, right? And those three things that he ticked off were electric vehicles, autonomous vehicles, and ride sharing. And he says that the intersection of those three things he thinks is going to be very important. Now, mm-hmm. he hasn't said that in at least a year, maybe a year and a half or two. Right? So it is always possible that that it's become less important to Apple. To wit, Apple did lay off at least a portion of its team members, as we discussed this morning on TDO.
As we also discussed on TDO this morning, I hypothesized that was an R&D segment of the overall program that didn't pan out. And
right, we don't have information. Research.
Yeah, but I've been on projects like that before, and you usually have similar groups that are competing with each other. You have multiple groups. You have multiple tracks towards an end goal. You'll have somebody who says, let's try it this way, and the leader of the group says, okay, take a team and go try it. And then another guy raises his hand. He says, I think we should take a different approach. Here's my technical approach to it. I think we should pan that, should see if that pans out. And the R&D leader says, okay, here's some money. You go try that. And whoever finishes the job first, come back and report to me and tell me how it's going. And so the team that maybe doesn't succeed is, instead of being reassigned because they're so specialized, they end up getting laid off. Apple tends to
right.
do that.
That all of that is very possible. And I imagine that that's probably what happened in this particular case.
I have a
suspicion. My point, though, is we don't know.
No, we don't. But we can look at analogs and other R&D organizations. I've been in them. And I can appeal to my experience and hypothesize that, rather than saying I just simply don't know.
Well, we can also... I feel much more strongly about this, that this was not Apple gutting the entire program, the entire Project
Correct.
Titan.
I agree.
That would have been hundreds and hundreds of people that have been laid off or reassigned, and not 190 because if you look at the makeup of the people that were laid off in the engineering side, there are 38 engineering program managers. And then a combination of another 86 hardware engineers, product design engineers, and software engineers. Well, that to me says that like 38 engineering program managers are not managing 86 other engineers.
Right. Sometimes managers get highfalutin titles and end up reporting to other managers.
Right. So there's still a lot other, there are more other engineers working in this project.
Yeah, you might have had an engineer reporting to an engineer reporting to an engineer, and the lowest program manager has six people reporting to him. So, could be,
right.
layers and layers.
All right, so getting back to robots and Apple, I like your thoughts on this sort of... The task of autonomous driving, or even self-driving autonomous driving.
As Ford says, job one.
Could form the foundation of doing a lot of other stuff in robotics.
Right.
And that is true. And I would also, when we discussed this issue before the show... there is a difference in the kinds of robotics that Apple has, that we know Apple is working on, i.e. on the manufacturing side. There's a difference between that and the kind of robotics needed for anything aimed at families or individuals.
And there's a lot to be done with the non-self-aware aspect of Siri and its ability to understand human language. Because when you get into the ride-sharing vehicle and you say, take me to Blue Star Mall, you don't want to be driven to Missouri and dropped off at the Blue Star restaurant. There's a lot of nuance in human behavior. And our car systems right now are pretty frustrating many ways. Just watch Top Gear or Grand Tour.
And so are AIs.
Siri. I asked Siri the other day. I said, Siri, tell me, what was the second Wednesday in February? And Siri came back right away and said, February 6th, which is absurd. I mean, just mathematically off the cuff, it's wrong because it hasn't spanned 7 days yet.
Yeah. Yeah,
but looking at the calendar confirms that the second Wednesday of February was not the 6th. How can Siri make a mistake like that in 2019? Boggles my mind.
It boggles my mind too. And kind of speaking to the original point that we're never going to be able to make computer systems that encompass the awe and majesty of the human mind. What we're seeing with AI today, it lends credence to that person's hypothesis.
So
follow that convoluted thought?
No, I didn't. So excellent. I was just going to move on.
Excellent. That's great.
If you force me to admit my ignorance, I will.
Well, no, I think this would be the convoluted nature in which I expressed it. So I'm referring to the fellow who said that. And I poo-pooed his idea, right? I said that I disagree with him strongly, that we would never have...
Oh, Dr. Kai Fooley?
Yeah. And to his point, though, when you look at this current state of AI, including Apple's efforts to have genuine AI and then Amazon's efforts to have faux AI... It lends credence to his to the doctor's theories.
You know, there's a technical term for artificial intelligence with respect to things like Buddhist clergymen or playing chess, and then there's what's called AGI, which is the broader augmented artificial general intelligence is a term the community uses to refer to a human-like, all-encompassing, general-purpose problem-solving mind that goes beyond a mere specialized AI.
Mm-hmm.
Just a point of nomenclature there for us.
All right. Sweet. So,
are you ready to talk about robot killers?
Sure.
So I read an article the other day. I forget where it was. I think I saved it for particle debris. That there are currently no regulations. I have to pause.
Yeah, no regulations covering whether or not a robot can kill, has the right to kill, the power to kill, etc.
Right. So right now we're kind of in a luxury situation where we are exploiting robots for military purposes and envisioning that robots can go to war for us. That robots under some human supervision, like drone predators in the sky, can supervision, but remotely and as a robot, you know, kill. But eventually we'll get to the point where the military will say, you know, we're going to let these guys go on their own and be autonomous. And then right away that's going to trickle into law enforcement. And then you're going to have issues with robots gone wrong and people dying at the hands of robots, and all sorts of kerfuffles will ensue. And then we have to follow the money and the politics of that, and it'll be tough.
Yeah, let's talk about the politics. So one of the great limitations of any particular government's ability to wage war is the cost in blood. It's blood and treasure is the usual nomenclature. The blood side of that is human lives. And usually, from the standpoint of government, that's referring to the human lives of soldiers that are lost in a war.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have too many people dying, the populace becomes weary of the war. And so if you can remove that component, many governments would feel far more enabled to use military force to achieve its objectives more easily.
I agree. Exactly.
And this is something that doesn't just affect our government. I mean, like, you know, if you look at the U.S., you look at China, and you look at Russia, the U.S. and China in particular are all three countries are, I am sure, working on this particular kind of thing. And drones are just the start of it. I mean, drones are a kind of robot, but and there are reports of drones that are essentially autonomous, which is scary.
Well, cruise missiles are autonomous, too. I mean, once you unleash the cruise missile, it uses GPS navigation to find its way to the target.
Yeah, but,
it's autonomous.
But that's a dumb autonomy. That's not a smart autonomy.
The missile isn't making any decisions.
The missile isn't making decisions. You push the button
and it goes.
Right.
We're talking about the context of a clash where a robot has to make a conscious, human-like decision to kill or not to kill.
Yeah, or destroy or not destroy.
Yep, yep.
And this is absolutely going to be a thing. And what John mentioned is also going to be a thing, is that these technologies will trickle down or percolate down to law enforcement.
And to that end, the rules of warfare are different than the rules of law enforcement in polite society, too. The things you can do in war are considered appropriate amongst uniformed, armed individuals in declared combat, can do things that citizens cannot do. And so we have to make a distinction. Once this technology trickles down to law enforcement, we may have to have different rules for these robots. For example, a robot may have to follow a certain regulation that says it cannot physically harm a human being. It can interfere. It can use its body weight. It can try to defuse a situation through talking. But when the chips are down, it has to call for backup, human backup, to make a life and death decision about whether somebody's in danger.
And such systems are going to be deployed long before they're ready to go. I'm confident of that. We're going to have... And don't get me wrong, I am very against the militarization of the police here in the United States. I have strongly held convictions that the negatives from militarizing our police far outweigh the positives. And that said, I am absolutely for robot diffusing or robot containment devices for bombs. Like if we can not have to have a human risk his or her life to deal with some idiot's bomb, that's fantastic. And that's a role that is super well suited for robots, and so is being able to get intelligence in any kind of like a hostage situation.
If you can remember the kids who were boycotting or protesting at a California college a couple years ago, they were sitting peacefully, and they were pepper sprayed. Do you remember that case?
Yeah, I do remember that. Yeah.
So one can envision a situation where an artificial intelligence agent robot would be able to conduct itself by program control much more intelligently in the face of a peaceful protest, as opposed to letting emotions take over or saying, I don't like the way this person dresses or looks and they must be evil, or I'm going to pepper spray them.
Yeah. Okay.
There could be advantages in that respect.
That is at best going to be a series of trade-offs, because the robot's going to have other kinds of mistakes in judgment that humans take for granted, that the robots are not capable of.
Well, you can put these robots through simulators. You know, you can put them, it'd be like a Star Trek episode. You know, the robot isn't just programmed and then unleashed on the street. The robot will be put into a simulation and it'll have 1,000 tries to defuse.
Won't be enough. The stuff's going to be deployed before it's ready.
It'll learn from experience.
The stuff will be deployed before it's ready. You know that that's true.
No. By the time these robots are deployed for riot control, they'll have been in a simulation a million times and done everything wrong. There's a saying in the karate studio, you have to live. There's a saying I learned in karate, and that is you have to die 1,000 times in the dojo to live once on the street. These robots will die 1,000 times in a simulator before they're unleashed once.
Are you actually saying to me, John, that you think that that when we have riot control robots, that they're going to be like perfect out of the box? Like they hit the streets and they're ready to go?
Not out of the box, having simulator trained.
Oh my God. I cannot believe you're arguing that. I cannot believe you're arguing that. You know these things will hit the streets. I do not want robots doing riot control. I think that should be done by humans. Policing should be done by humans. Human judgment. There should be a relationship between the police force and the community. The police force should be part of the community.
It's hard for a human to separate the job that they're trying to do from the physical danger that they endure, and that aggravates them. And not everybody, even trained police officers, are able to separate those emotions.
When we have non-humans making those kinds of decisions, we are going to have massively negative repercussions in society.
So the police force should be... You throw a tomato at the robot, and the robot goes, okay, you know, no problem, I can deal with that.
Whatever, that's not the point. Great, robots can make all these impersonal, dispassionate, you know, quote-unquote decisions. I get that part. But the more important thing is that the police should be part of the community, because if they are not part of the community, you have a massive us and them.
Yeah, I know. They should be under the supervision of human beings. Human beings should be watching. And if a robot misbehaves, he's robot number 1,243,614 is terminated and brought out of the
You're missing my point. My point is the connection between the people. The people in the police force and the people that they are policing.
Before the show. Yeah, when robots appear to be an alien invading force instead of part of the community and our stakeholders and keeping the peace, people get irritated.
Irritated is extraordinarily polite and understandable.
And the friendly peacemaker robot is seen as an alien invader to the community, something to be destroyed, something to throw a Molotov cocktail at.
Yes. Something to throw a Molotov cocktail at. And it also engenders the wrong attitudes from whomever is managing the police force.
Well, here's your argument for looking like a human. What if this, you know, you talked about what's the motivation to make these robots human-like?
I did not say that. I just said...
Well, I'm putting words in your mouth for you.
I know. Don't do that, though. Because what I said sentient AI have to look human, because it won't.
All right. So stay with me in this argument. Okay. If you have a robot with stainless steel teeth and red eyes, yeah, you're going to throw the Molotov cocktail. But if it looks like your brother-in-law, human and vulnerable, and has a connection with you physically, you're less likely to destroy it, because in dim light, you might even mistake it for being a human being.
I have a TV show you should watch.
Okay.
Battlestar Galactica.
I never saw that show. I don't remember seeing it.
Did you watch the reboot?
Oh, you mean the 2003 series?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Religiously. What I did not enjoy was Caprica. I kind of lost interest. Caprica kind of lost
me. Oh, I liked Caprica. Caprica was good.
I was in and out on that, but I was fanatic about the actual Battlestar
series.
I was
very bummed when Caprica got canceled. Very bummed indeed. All right. So listen, John, we did have a second topic, and let me tell you where we are time-wise. We're at 52 minutes. So do you want to briefly get into foldable phones?
Yeah, I can do that.
All right. Shoot. Foldable phones. No.
Yesterday.
No, stop. Hold on.
Wait, hold the presses.
Yes, definitely hold the presses, because we're going to hear from our sponsor. We're going to hear about our sponsor, ExpressVPN. There is always lots of news about online security breaches, data breaches, passwords, logins, getting stolen by hackers or leaked to hackers, right? It's all over the place. And it's hard not to worry about where my data goes. Make an online purchase. It's like social media companies are tracking. We talk about that all the time. Marketing companies are tracking you. Your internet service provider can actually sell your browsing history. Right? I mean, come on. Right? So that's why I decided to take back my privacy by using ExpressVPN. It's super easy to use. You install the app. When you launch it, it puts a button right there. Just a button on a window. It's a button that says connect. You choose where you want to connect to, or just use the default, the local suggestion. You can decide which apps are using the VPN, right? It could be either like your entire Mac or just a specific app. And then to disconnect, it's just another click of the button. It's super easy to use. I love the software. It's really, really good. So, the thing is because they're sponsoring us, you can get 3 months free at expressvpn.com/ACM. That's expressvpn.com/ACM. And that's 3 months free with a 1 year package because they're sponsoring my show. So all you have to do is visit expressvpn.com/ACM to learn more. I sure appreciate them sponsoring us, and I sure wish that you will check them out. Okay, John.
All right, so I wrote an article yesterday called Genuine Courage, Apple Shouldn't Build a Foldable iPhone. We've heard a lot of discussion about Huawei and Samsung building foldable phones. It seems like a gimmick to me. I've been reading the articles about it. They're not yet available. They're going to cost near $2,000. The display obviously would be some sort of foldable plastic as opposed to being a very pleasing hard glass, because you can't get glass to bend. There's going to be warranty issues, I'm sure, besides the cost. It takes two hands to handle the phone, and there's a lot of people who are accustomed to and like the idea of handling the phone with one hand. Not to say that all Apple phones would become foldable, but it is an issue with some people manipulating the phone and operating it. Finally, there's the issue for developers. When you have a phone that folds out from one size display to a second size display, there's probably going to be so on-screen management issues of apps and the way they display. So there's the price, there's the material science, durability, one-handed usage, and issues for developers. And it kind of feels gimmicky to me. So I concluded in the article that Apple will probably do it for some phones just because they're sexy, but I hope they don't. And Apple engineers always seem to have a better solution than the competition. So I hope that happens.
Well, I think we can take a step back a little bit too, because what the non-Apple part of the market has done since the iPhone was introduced is throw spaghetti at the wall, mm-hmm. right? See what sticks.
Yeah.
And
work out the Apple.
They're like the singularly successful example of that would be large screen smartphones. That was one of the things that Samsung tried, and it was the one thing that worked, and it's actually the thing that made Samsung and also ran in the smartphone market and turned it into the perceived competition for Apple. And I think that this will be one of the things that is tried and the market doesn't react positively to it, and it'll slide down the wall, it won't stick, and we'll move on to something else.
I equated it to 3D television, something that was sexy, cool, everybody had to do it, everybody did do it, went over like a lead balloon with customers.
Yep. Yeah, and I think that'll be the case with the foldable phones. I mean, eventually, so like one of the things I've been talking about a lot, John, is not a lot, but I talked about this at the Silicon Valley Mac User Group on Monday, and I talked about how, you know, where iPhone is headed is probably to our personal and central mobile processing device that and our displays will increasingly become, you know, glasses, being able to hook up to any kind of, you know, like at the very least when you're out and about, your iPhone or whatever Apple's calling the iPhone at that time will work as a standalone mobile device. But when you get back to your desk, that's actually what interfaces with whatever kind of display and improved input devices that you're using, i.e. today we would think of mm-hmm. as a keyboard and mouse.
And I like that. I agree.
And that's probably where we're heading. And I think that things like glasses with AR and eventually contact lenses that can also do AR. I think that those
projected displays in space
and projected displays like on in space,
science fiction television, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and flexibility
and eventually holographic displays. And I think that things like that will supersede something like a foldable smartphone long before a foldable smartphone could be made to actually work and work well. Right. Referring in part to your point about, you know, like the fact that you've got to have plastic. And there's a hinge there.
Actually,
like hinges, you know, hinges are hard. Hinges are very hard to do.
They said they spent 3 years doing it. But you know what? I wrote in my article, the managers always are ready to ship before the engineers are perfectly happy. And you can just see the handwriting on the wall that after a year or so of abuse, there's going to be cracks or there's going to be material science issues with these mm-hmm. foldable phones. Mm-hmm. It's not an attractive engineering solution.
And I think that other technologies are going to solve whatever it is they're trying to solve with these, right? Whatever market use that they're seeing with these devices, I think that other technologies and other approaches will supersede this solution for those problems.
Bingo. Bingo, bingo, bingo. It's a strained, artificial, mechanical approach to a problem that needs a more elegant solution.
That's right. The way I would say the analogy would be netbooks, right? And if you remember what Tim Cook, this is when I came up with the Cook Code concept.
Oh yeah.
Is that Apple saw the need, the market need that was being addressed by netbooks, which were all the rage, right? It was all the rage. And like there was a couple of years, this is funny now, but there was a couple of years where like Wall Street was obsessed with when Apple's going to do a netbook. And famously, I think it was Katie Huberty but I may be misapplying this to her or misattributing this to her. But there was an analyst who downgraded Apple because Apple had not yet articulated a netbook strategy that wouldn't also cut into their laptop revenues.
I finished my article with Apple engineers always have a better vision.
Right. And the point is that Apple denigrated netbooks without ever denigrating the use that netbooks were being put to. And Apple essentially said that we can satisfy that need with what became the iPad better than it is solved with the netbook, because netbooks offer an inferior experience.
That kind of genuine innovation gets overlooked.
Yes. And I think that that'll be the case here. I think that foldable phones, except for foldable phones, will never get as much traction as netbooks.
I agree.
Right. Netbooks were hot sellers for a while because they were super cheap.
And $2,000 is, and that's the entry point.
Well, that's to be fair, that's also the first generation. But I mean, like if they could get those things down to $1,000, I'd be surprised. And even still, it's going to be a device that has problems. Your material science point, John, I think is the most salient of all of these things that we're talking about, all the criticisms.
Yeah, when you spend $2,000 on a phone, you expect it to be perfect and last forever.
Yeah.
Expectations.
Yeah, and I don't want to drag my finger across soft, pliable plastic.
Right.
Right? I want to drag it across glass.
Yeah, and do we really need the second screen?
Well,
we've been functioning for how many years now?
I don't
since 2007.
I don't think that's the right point, because
It's just one leg of the argument, and that is, what can you? You have to stop and think about what can you do with that extra display size when you unfold the display. What new things that are fundamental to the phone experience are enabled that weren't enabled before?
Well,
that's what you have to ask.
It's the tablet. It's the tablet experience. It's the tablet experience and phone experience all in one. It's just, but no one, I don't think anyone.
But do people need to transition from a phone experience to a tablet experience on the fly with an unfold?
Need is not the answer. That's crucial. Do they want? Do they want? And that's why I brought up the netbook example. Because there is something to the idea of being able to have that sort of flexibility all in one device. To wit, I carry my iPad with me wherever I go. I've got a man purse. Strap that man purse on my back, and I've got my and I carry my iPad with me wherever I go because I might get 5 minutes to read. And if I've got 5 minutes to read, I want to take 5 minutes to read. God forbid I actually have to sit there and not do anything. And my point is that I can see the idea of wanting to have one device that can do both things, although it's so, like, it's so imperfect.
We know the rat hole that leads. It doesn't work with aircraft between the Navy and the Air Force, where you build an F-111 that suits both services.
It's going to be pleasing
in other fields.
It's going to be pleasing for neither.
It doesn't work with what's the word toaster fridges.
Toaster fridges, yeah. But you know, Tim Cook hasn't said toaster fridge in years, right? So anyway, the market want or need, I don't think that's the issue. What I think is if there is an issue that is being solved by these devices, by these two devices that are out so far, or semi been announced at least, if there is a market need being satisfied by those devices, that need can be better satisfied with other technologies, perhaps 2 or 3 or 4 years down the line, but it can be better solved in other ways. And that's what I think will happen.
Could be a head fake, too, trying to get Apple to expend money to be a competitor.
Well, that's a ridiculous head fake, because I guarantee you that Samsung spent a larger percentage of its monies developing this than Apple would spend on its monies to develop this. Right? Apple has, trying to get Apple to waste money is surely, you know, is surely... pissing in the wind.
Well, it could deflect Apple. It could cause Apple to focus on trying to do a better job. Mr. Simon at Macworld said Apple should build a foldable phone because they should show us how to do it right and lead the way. Well, if Apple's going to do something right, I guarantee you they're going to build a foldable phone that feels right and won't crack and won't have material science issues and will last for a long, long time.
Except for those things aren't possible.
It's going to take a lot of money.
Those things aren't possible. Apple will instead solve whatever problem this thing is trying to address with other technologies that make more sense.
That's why I said in my article, Apple should not build a foldable phone.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, completely.
Cool. And with that, I think we've done it.
We are, in fact, over. We are at 106 plus the advertising spot that I'm going to add in post. So with that, Check this out. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to add, comment on, or question, write us at acm@macobserver.com or write me at acm@macobserver.com. Our bandwidth is provided by CacheFly, the basis by Boom, recorded just for TMO. Our sponsor was ExpressVPN. We very, very, very much appreciate their sponsorship. And that is all for this week, John. Thank you very, very much for joining me.
My pleasure. It was great to be here. That was a lot of fun, Brian.
It was. It was a whole lot of fun. And now I'm going to do this.